You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is the 6th of April 2017 and you are listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Today I'm joined by our regular co-host, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing better. Many of our listeners realize that I haven't done an Orthodox Nationalist in 2 weeks. I want to apologize to my listeners. I've missed quite a bit this year. And that's simply because I've been very sick. So I ask your indulgence in that respect. It's that simple. So thank you, Sven, for being tolerant in that regard as well.
That's no worries. We all get ill. At least you've managed to make it for a couple of Daily Traditionalists this week. And I know the last episode we did went down really well. People really enjoyed that, the subject matter about Christians and pagans. And maybe we'll be able to get into some more of that at the end of today's episode. We've got lots of stuff to look at today. Important things in the news. Steve Bannon stepping down from the Security Council, and also what's going on in Syria. But before we get into that, I'd just like to remind people of our political prisoner Lawrence Burns. Last year he was sent on a remand, so they haven't even actually sentenced him yet. They found him guilty of making private Facebook posts that were critical of ethnic minorities. They've told him that they're going to come down on him like a ton of bricks, and they've sent him to prison. These were private Facebook posts, comments between friends. The police had to break into the account, and then they wrote down what they found in the account in biro. And yet this case should have been thrown out of court, but it wasn't. He was sent to prison. He's in prison at the moment. We just like him to know that we are thinking of him. We are keeping his name out there as much as we can. We want people to remember Lawrence Burns. And if anyone's got the time, then please could they write to him. I'll try and find the address of the prison that he's at. And I'll put that in the article for today. So just remember that we do have political prisoners, and Lawrence Burns is one that could really do with some support from people, I think. And back to the program today. It's all this Syria nonsense. I keep seeing people getting very upset about Donald Trump and what he is saying about Syria, about how Assad gassed these people. Now, I don't think that Assad gassed his people whatsoever, but I do think the Syrian Air Force was particularly reckless to go bombing a weapons depot, especially when they knew it was a weapons depot, and they also knew that it was likely to contain chemical weapons. Chemical weapons had been shipped from there to Iraq. The Iraqi government have confirmed this. So if you know that there's a factory and the likelihood is that there's going to be the chlorine in there and possibly other chemical weapons, it's not really a good idea to go bombing it when it's surrounded by civilians. And if you do go bombing it when it's surrounded by civilians, it's going to look very, very badly on the president that actioned that. So it's not as black and white as it first seems, I think, this situation, Matt. Obviously, I don't want Donald Trump to go to war against Bashar al-Assad, but you really have to place some of the blame for this on the Syrian Air Force. They should have gone in there with ground troops. It's kind of like going into a firework factory with a cigarette in your hand, flicking it away, and then saying, well, it's not my fault all the fireworks went off. Because they did know that there were weapons there. They did know that there was a likelihood that there would be chemical weapons there. So it all just seems very, very suspicious to me. Maybe this is something that other people have already said, but I haven't found anyone actually pointing this fact out. So it was a stupid thing for the Syrian Air Force to do. But what are your thoughts on it, Matt, anyway?
Well, the controversy, you know, I've read several pieces on this now, both from the Russian side and from the in the English language, and the controversy seems to be that they knew it was a weapons depot, I knew they made bombs there. But the headlines are that they bombed a chemical weapons plant. That doesn't mean that they knew in advance that it was. That it would have been ridiculously stupid if that were the case. But I can't find any evidence that they knew ahead of time. That would have been an awful thing to do. I'm not sure what they thought the place was. It's not like they have, that intelligence is going to the CIA, not to the Syrians. So what they knew, I'm not entirely sure.
And I think another point that should be made is that if it wasn't Assad that did it, then it has to have been the rebels that did it. And these rebels are backed by America, they're backed by the EU. And if all those civilians, 70 of them, were killed by this gas attack, if it became known that it was the rebels that did this, then America and the EU would look really bad. So I can understand people lying about it and claiming it was Assad, because if it wasn't Assad, then it means they're responsible for it. What I don't get is why Donald Trump seems to be so keen on actually blaming Assad for this and beating the drums of war and hinting that he's not going to give any advance warning if he goes in there. It just seems that if there is any criticism to be made, it's that the Syrian army have been reckless. They knew that there were weapons there. They should have sent ground troops in. As I say, the Iraqi government have confirmed that there were chemical weapons coming from the rebels in Idlib that were then being used in Mosul. So they knew there was something to do with chemicals there. To then go bombing the place, really, it's just handing a propaganda coup to the West, isn't it? Really,
the good news is that it does exonerate Assad. He didn't go, using chemical weapons on populations. And this is at least the second accusation. And now that even pro-American governments in Iraq have confirmed that the rebels, in fact, had chemical weapons at the warehouse that was hit by the Syrian Air Force. That makes the West look awful, and they're between a rock and a hard place right now, no pun intended, because if they could accuse Assad of being reckless, but then they'd also have to say that our friends had chemical weapons there. So this is good news for Assad in general.
Yeah, that's the problem. I guess they're thinking, well, the end result is the same. Whether the planes dropped chemical weapons on the people or whether the planes dropped bombs that then set off a factory full of chemical weapons, the end result is the same. 70 Syrians are dead and lots of injured and lots of babies. So rather than blame it on the rebels, we're going to blame it on Assad and the Air Force, because whether they dropped bombs on to a target that was full of gas or whether they dropped bombs that contained gas, the end result is the same thing. So I'm guessing that maybe that is the way that Trump is looking at it. I'm trying to give him the benefit of doubt here, because I do want to believe that he has some integrity and that he really doesn't want to go starting wars in the Middle East. And I know a lot of people are feeling very let down by him. So I'm trying to think of possible reasons why he could be acting in the way that he is. There's also the situation with Steve Bannon. Lots of people are very upset at the fact that he's been removed from the Security Council. But I always thought Steve Bannon was a propagandist. I don't know what he was doing on the Security Council in the first place. He's still Donald Trump's right-hand man. I believe he's still the chief of staff in the White House. He still has Donald Trump's ear. He's just not involved in the military side of it. Isn't that what the National Security Council is, Matt? It's something to do with the military, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly not something in Bannon's expertise. That is a very good question. I'm not sure about that. But yes, he is still in the White House. He's not been kicked out of the White House, as some of our friends have been saying.
Yeah, I think people do need to sort of take a little step back when things like this happen and not get carried away with what they're hearing in the media and try and think things through and think for possible reasons why these actions may have been taken. And then you're more likely to come up with something that's closer to what's really happening. We know that the press wants to demonize Donald Trump. We know they want to make out that he's going to turn his back on all of us and he's going to become the same as the establishment. So you have to be careful of that. But it was actually a BBC report that I saw which was saying that Steve Bannon is still very important position, and it was just the Security Council that he was removed from. But I've also seen lots of reports saying that's it, Donald Trump is now part of the establishment, we've got rid of Steve Bannon, and I believe they're blowing their trumpets too soon, really. I don't know if you want to add any more to this, or whether we should move on to what we were talking about last time that people seem to appreciate us talking about so much, Matt.
Well, on the Syrian case, I want to point out, and I had forgotten this, the UN joint mission in Syria in 2013, dedicated to searching for chemical weapons, concluded there was no chemical weapons in the Syrian government, and that whatever was there was sent back to Russia, where they got it from in the first place during the Cold War. So in 2013, Syria's enemies, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is connected to the UN, said that there were no chemical weapons in Syrian stores.
And they found chemical weapons in Aleppo, in the rebel held part. When they liberated Aleppo, they went in there. Okay, it was the Syrian people that were leading the Russian journalists to these areas, these weapon stashes. But inside these weapon stashes, there were drums filled with chlorine and various other chemicals. And you could see the chemical signs on the packets. I mean, it doesn't take much technology to make a chemical weapon. I mean, you can buy drums of chemicals just in a hardware store. In the West, imagine how many more chemicals you could buy at the hardware store in the Middle East and places where there aren't so many restrictions on the use of chemicals and acids. And I'm sure it's not too hard to mix household chemicals together to come up with some kind of lethal weapon that you could then put into gas cylinders. In fact, this is what they were showing you. They were showing you gas cylinders and fuses, and they were saying that the chemicals were put in these cylinders, the fuses were then jammed into the top, and then they were fired. And these were these homemade chemical weapons that the rebels had been using. So we do have evidence of them using this stuff, but we don't actually have any evidence of Assad doing it. As you say, Matt, they inspected all his weapons, the same as they had weapons inspectors in Iraq who said there are no weapons of mass destruction. And then we were told there were weapons of mass destruction. They went to war over there, and then they discovered, well, no, actually, there weren't any. And once again, we've had inspectors look through all the weapon stashes that the Syrian government have. They've confirmed that there are no chemical weapons there, and yet somehow, a year later, we're being told that these are chemical weapons belonging to the Syrian government. This is the only thing.
I want to stress that Israel has forbidden any organization from inspecting its nuclear or chemical stores. There's something you said in the last show that I was on, Sven. There's an article by Tony Cartellucci, a man who I admire very much as a journalist, who confirms your suspicion that the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is one guy in Coventry, who's financed by the West. This isn't, you know, even the New York Times admitted that. So it's a completely fraudulent organization. One very, very Jewish-looking guy, that runs it. And this is all it is. He just simply sends out press releases according to the needs of the CIA. And that's all that organization is.
Well, yes, he's the Syrian Observer for Human Rights in England. At least Russia and Syria have actually got people on the ground. They've got people that can report on what's going on in Syria, whereas the West is relying on somebody who is not even in Syria. And when you're talking about the authenticity of documents, if you're looking back through history and you're looking to see how accurate a historical document is, the person that is writing closest to the area that he's writing about and closest to the time that he is writing about, he's the one who's afforded the most belief. He's the one who's likely to be the most accurate. So if you're looking at this, you can say, well, Russia and Syria, they've got people right there in Idlib at the time that this chemical weapon went off. So is their testimony to be believed, or is the testimony to be believed of somebody over the other side of the world in England?
It's well, let me make ridiculous. It very clear. As I said the last time, I want to say it again, that any NGO, whether one man or more, is nothing more than a political spokesman for a group of corporations, economic corporations only. It's big money involvement in politics directly. And it's very, very easy to show. You go to their website and it'll go right to their donor list and it'll be on there. So we have to be very, the NGOs are a threat in the sense that they don't represent anybody except the very wealthy.
And the West haven't had any journalists in Syria for years now. They did have some that were embedded with the terrorists at one point, but they haven't had any now for a good couple of years. The only people that have had journalists there are the Russians. So we do have to believe what the Russians tell us, because they are actually there on the ground. And whoever is there on the ground is the one that we want to be listening to, I think. After we made that podcast last week, I got lots of positive comments about the discussion that we were having about Christians and pagans and the arguments that Christians and pagans have together. And I believe you wrote an article about this, Matt, which has been published. And I was just wondering whether you could summarize what was in that, and maybe we could talk about that a little bit.
Yes, it's going to be coming out in the Barnes Review, the next issue. At that time, I'll post it on my website. It's the essential argument is that there is no, paganism isn't a religion. It has no theology. It has no heretics. It has no creed. It's simply a way that people it's identical with culture. It's simply how people humanize the world around them. The very fact that they personalized it and even ritualized it doesn't make it any more of a religion than Eric Clapton's fans believing that he's God makes that a religion. If the pagan worship of the pagan gods was actually a religious worship in the same sense that Muslims worship Allah or Christians worship Jesus, then words religion and worship are useless. It is no different than saluting the flag or the Statue of Liberty with the Liberty Bell. That's all these are. It's easier to tell stories and to personalize things, and that's how people remember it. That's how it gets into the culture rather than expository prose. So that's all these are. Hesiod, when he wrote the Theogony, didn't believe that he was a prophet. He didn't believe that he was a transmission belt for the gods. He simply was summarizing the stories that were always changing and knowingly changing from before his day. And you know, what we have are fragments that are very different from one another, and it's simply they were changed to fit the political mood or the social mood. And you know, in Greece and Rome, the festivals of these gods were civic events. They were political events. Aristotle goes into great detail about this. These aren't religions in the sense that we in 2017 would use the word religion. That's the central argument.
Well, I know that religion used to be more of a way of life. It wasn't seen as separate. It wasn't something that was separate that you did. The whole culture was steeped in it. If you look at Hinduism today, it's still fairly similar. So what it was really a way of describing and understanding the world around them. So today we would have, say, a weather forecast that would say that we've got storms coming in, we've got wind at such and such a mile an hour and rain at such and such a mile an hour, whereas instead of thinking of it as wind and rain, they would think of it as these mythic beings, the gods getting angry or the gods dropping the rain on the soil. So is that sort of what you were saying? It was a way of explaining the world around them in the same way that we have science today to do that?
Well, we're still personalizing hurricanes. We personalize things all the time. Sometimes we call our cars she. Boats are always she. B.B. King named his guitar Lucille. That's simply how human beings are. We personalize things. That's how we comprehend it. Now, I believe possibly the simple people believe that the gods existed, but the elites did not. They were quite aware. The intellectuals did not. They were aware that these were archetypes. These were symbols. And if you were to go through these stories, something that's mythical, by the way, is not false. It's true at its essence, just fanciful in detail. You get what is essentially the constitution of the society. If we cease seeing paganism as religion and seeing it as just this, cultural explanation, the animosity between pagans and Christians will disappear, because there'd be no competition in that case. We'll be comparing apples and oranges. There is no pagan religion as such. The way that we use the word doesn't apply to what they were doing. The problem is that we use the word God to refer to Yahweh and Zeus, and that's created tremendous confusion. In fact, in my paper, I quote the great Plato scholar G.M.A. Grube, who says that Theos, the Greek word, doesn't mean God. It can, but it doesn't. It means anything that lasts longer than a human life. So, nationalism, the patriotism of a city, something like that, would all be Theos, according to the Athenian view of things. It's a false use of the word to refer to these things as gods in the sense that we will call Yahweh God. It's not the same thing, and that we need to have a different word to describe it, and it caused a lot of confusion.
Well, I think we also have these archetypes as well, parts of the mind and parts of consciousness. I think they would name the gods after them as well, and people that they would see in their dreams, the psychopomps, I think they were, or is that the one that transfers people from the dead to the land of the dead, basically. But I think they would see people within their dreams as well, and dreams would maybe people in their dreams would maybe instruct them, and they would tend to give them names. And I think their whole way of looking at life around them, everything about them was different to the way we think about things today. And they had a certain moral laws that they all had to uphold to, which were a part of it. Doing the right thing by the gods was upholding the moral law. And today we seem to have turned our back on our God and on Christianity. And in the same way, we've turned our back on these moral laws that were absolutes before. And I don't think there was any real animosity between these Christians and the pagans. It's only in a very, very few areas that there was trouble when Christianity actually came to the area. There was no trouble in Britain. I don't think there was any in France. I can think of the areas where there was trouble. There was trouble in the Balkans, and that wasn't the Baltics, rather, and that wasn't until the 11th, 12th century. And there was trouble with Charlemagne when he put down one grove full of pagans that were politically didn't want to be part of his empire. But
these were the Saxons, and these were there was a strictly a political and military thing. He didn't see it as a religious attack. I said the last time, and I'll repeat it now, that really Christianity has created the concept of paganism. Christianity has its canon law and its Bible and its creed, and they wanted to attack the actual worship of these gods by the simple people. And so they created this religion, a unified conceptual apparatus that they could attack that didn't actually exist. You could actually climb Mount Olympus, for Christ's sakes. And the proof of it, well, in England, as you mentioned, Gregory the Great told St. Augustine that all the local customs, he didn't refer to paganism at all. He said all the local customs that you find there, you keep unless they are obviously opposed to the faith, which were very, very few. So there was no concept that he didn't believe that this was a separate religion. He just understood it as a personalization of social forces or natural forces. The deification of the emperor in Rome is really proof of my thesis. The emperor died. The emperor made mistakes. The emperor could be overthrown. The emperor obviously wasn't God or a god. It's a completely abuse of the term. all that meant was theos, in the sense that the Greeks used it. He was the fighter of order and natural law against chaos, which is really what the gods were in the mind of people who knew. They were abstractions, but they were very real. They weren't persons. They weren't people that you could talk to, but they were at war with chaos. And this is what the story of the gods versus the titans in ancient Greece was all about, natural law versus the passions. And so obviously if you call the emperor a god, they're not using the word god in the same way that we are, and nothing even close to it in ancient Rome. So it's just, it's caused so much confusion, and so much of what the neo-pagans do is made up and concocted, because very little is known about pagan life prior to the introduction of literacy in Northern Europe.
So it was really like village traditions, just traditions that people had, that they'd had for donkey's years, things that they did at certain times of year, things, ways that they referred to certain natural phenomena, and that was all written down by the Christians once Christianity took hold. There weren't any pagan books like we have the scripture, like we have the books of the Bible. There were some records of poems that were written, and also some of these deities were also kings. I mean, you got Thor and Odin, they're names of Scandinavian kings. I mean, you can even go back to Bacchus, he was a king as well. And I think another point that you often hear that is really false is that Christianity was a slave religion. It was a revolt of the slaves. It wasn't the slaves at all. It was the princes and the kings. It was the educated people that studied the Christian scriptures, that were brought the gospel by the apostles, and then became Christian. And then the rest of the nation followed. And you had Christianity coming into Britain at a very early stage, about 70 AD, with Caractacus and his family from Wales, and King Lucius in 170 AD, he pronounced the whole nation Christian, and this was in 170 AD, and that was the king that did that, and that was by unanimous consent of the people, and a lot of the Druids became bishops, the Archflamens became archbishops, the Druidic colleges became monasteries and bishoprics, and the studying continued there. And there was a seamless transition from Druidry to Christianity. There was no changing in the laws, no changing in the way that they did things, and there was no marches, there was no war between them. And I find it very interesting that both Druidry and Christianity were outlawed by the Roman Empire. So it made sense that Christians would come to Britain. And that was the original church that Augustine found, that was in Wales. So when Augustine was talking, when Gregory the Great said to Augustine to leave the traditions alone, he was talking about Augustine converting the Saxons, because the Britons, who were by that time, but they were the Welsh, they were already Christian. They already had a Christian church. They met up with Augustine, and they had a bit of an argument about the time of Easter. And they said that they were only going to pay the same obedience to the Pope that they would pay to any other Christian brother. But the Saxons themselves weren't Christian at the time. They took another couple of hundred years to actually become Christian. But there were already churches in Britain, and that's written about by Bede. So we have a peaceful transition from paganism to Christianity in Britain. And yet still we get people claiming that Christianity was brought to us at the end of the sword. It was a slave religion. It wasn't. It was from the princes and the kings, and then the people would follow, because they would obviously want to do what the king did.
I'm not really sure how a slave religion can be spread by the sword. That's a contradiction in terms. There were Christian communities, certainly, especially of a Celtic nature, in the islands prior to Augustine. Augustine brought it under Rome and introduced the Roman Rite, which is why we call it the Liturgy of St. Gregory today. They had no sense of themselves being pagans. You're absolutely right about that. There's something weird about modern science. If You know, these descriptions, these concepts they had about the world were actually quite profound in the ancient world. But the minute you add a personality to it, it becomes a myth and they dismiss it. If you know, when you understand that paganism is not a religion, it has no religious element to it, it's a secular, poetic way of understanding the world, you could then look at it with new eyes and see the profundity and the importance of these stories and how impressive they were and how so many of them were accordance with natural law. They didn't know the author of natural law, but as you said already, but they were in accordance with it. There were some customs in certain villages that were awful, like you said, like in the Sute practice in India. Later on, when they discovered this, there's practices like that, but these were few and far between.
Yeah, get rid of the practices that were harmful to them and keep the practices that were good. I don't see a conflict in it at all. I love to learn about my history, and the European people, the white race, didn't just start 2,000 years ago. It's been here for thousands of years. We have a rich and varied history, and the major part of it was pagan, although that probably wasn't, there wasn't as much literature around then that we can actually look at. But I just love learning about my heritage, Matt, whether it's Christian or whether it's pagan. It's all white, and that's what matters. Anyway, we're near the end of the podcast, so I better say thank you very much for coming on, Matt. I really appreciate it, and I know our listeners will have enjoyed the podcast today. Tomorrow we've got Matthew Heimbach back at the Daily Traditionalist, so make sure you tune in then. Thanks for listening. Have a great day, and hail victory.
Be tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.